session number 12279, reel 3.
Captain Brown, reel 3. Can you tell me what your memories are about the Royal Aircraft establishment at Farnborough in the last couple of years of the war, 44-45, please?
Well, this was probably the most exhilarating period of my life, because we, as you say, the war was peaking, and we were very involved in research work in trying to improve our aircraft to be considerably superior to those of the enemy. One must realize that German aviation technology was very, very advanced indeed. And after all, they had already flown a jet long before us, about a year before we did. And they had even flown a twin jet before we flew our first jet. Nevertheless, we were very involved in assessing German aircraft during this period. Whenever an aircraft crashed in this country, a German aircraft, if at all possible, it was refurbished and to a state where we could fly it and test it, so that we could pass the information on to our armed forces of how it performed, what its strengths were, what its weaknesses were. So this is very important work. At the same time, the Americans sent every type of operational aircraft that they produced to Farnborough. And so we had a multitude of aircraft coming through Farnborough, being tested, and we were able to compare the American aircraft with our own, with the Germans, and so one learned from each something new. Then, of course, when the war actually ended in 1945, because I was German-speaking, I was whistled over to Germany literally two or three days before the actual war ended to move in behind our troops as they overran airfields and pick up as many German aircraft as possible, or which were of particular interest to us, experimental aircraft or advanced aircraft, fly them back to Farnborough for assessment. And of course the war finished not many weeks after this, and we were able then to sit back and test these thoroughly. And it was quite a shock in many ways to find out that in some areas they were at least 5 years ahead of us, particularly in the area of high-speed flight with swept-back wings, in rocket flight, and in jet flight. Now, when I was at Farnborough, we had a top-secret flight there of jet aircraft. So I was fortunate enough to fly the very first jet this country ever produced, and the ones that we subsequently produced, and also America's very first jet. And we were able to assess them all, and the Germans were ahead of Americans and ourselves at this stage, which was quite a remarkable effort when you consider how Germany was slowly but surely being bombed, or had been slowly but surely bombed into a state of almost utter ruin, and that their country was doomed to be overrun by our troops eventually, and by the Russians, of course, and the Americans. So it was a truly remarkable effort. many ways, I sit back and think it's just as well the war ended when it did. Of course, one has to say this. Spite of the fact that they had these magnificent aeroplanes, where they had a problem was they had a bottleneck in experienced pilots. They had lost a huge number of pilots, and they hadn't any training schools that weren't being bombed out of existence. We were fortunate in this country because, unlike the Germans, we put our operational pilots on tours of duty, but then we rested them after a while. Not so in Germany. You were in from day one till the day you dropped. And their training schools, of course, as I say, were being heavily bombed, whereas ours were well dispersed in America, Canada, Rhodesia, South Africa, etc. So we had many, we had all these advantages.
Why do you think the Germans got so far ahead with technical developments in aeronautics and so on?
Fundamentally, they had some brilliant men in this business, as aerodynamicists, brilliant designers, and they had gone along certain paths which we knew about, but elected not to go along. For example, swept wings were described by a German aerodynamicist at an open meeting in Italy in 1937. There were many British representatives there, but we didn't believe, presumably, what we heard, because we didn't follow it up. On the jet engine side, you had another situation. There is no question that Sir Frank Whittle was the first man to invent the practical jet engine. But we didn't seize on it as rapidly as the Germans did, because Pabst von Ohain, who was Frank Whittle's equivalent in Germany, freely acknowledges that he learned his fundamental knowledge about the jet engine from the Frank Whittle work. But he then developed it more rapidly because the government backed him, whereas in this country, Whittle was without the backing he should have had. As a result, the Germans went into the path of building axial flow engines, which today every jet in the world almost is axial flow, whereas the British went along the centrifugal flow line. I've talked this over with Sir Frank, and of course the reasons we went this way are very sound, because at that stage in the war, the centrifugal flow engine was much more reliable than the axial flow. And the German engines had a total scrap life of 25 hours, which is quite ridiculous. So there was that to be said for it, that we had more reliable engines, but in the end, the axial flow is the way to go if you wish to develop the engine to its ultimate.
How did you get to know Frank Whittle?
Oh, well, when we were in this jet flight, so Frank was a fairly frequent visitor. In fact, he was always extremely keen to come and fly the first jet aircraft, which after all had his engine in it. But we had been briefed that under no circumstances was he to be allowed to fly it, in case, because after all we were at a temperamental stage in the engine's development, in case where the aircraft was lost and we lost the designer with it. We couldn't afford under any circumstances to lose Sir Frank Whittle, or Air Commodore Whittle, as he then was. So it was as simple as that. You can't lose the aircraft and your top aircraft and your top man at the same time.
Was it difficult to stop him?
We were able to stop him by, shall I say, finagling around and pretending the aircraft was unserviceable, but I think it eventually became a bit of a game. I think Sir Frank realised very well that we had been told that he can, but nevertheless, he played a bit of a game. But he did indeed fly the second of the jets, the Meteor.
Who were the most impressive people and personalities at Farnborough when you first went there?
Well, Farnborough, of course, was stuffed full of brilliant scientists. But if you ask for the top names, the director, when I went there, was a very famous man called Sir William Farren. And he was followed by an equally brilliant man called Mr. Pering, P-E-R-R-I-N-G, and who unfortunately died at an early stage in his brilliant career. Nearer to me, and these were, after all, elevated positions at Farnborough, but I worked very closely with two absolutely brilliant scientists called Morian Morgan, who became Sir Morian Morgan, and Handel Davis. Now, both these men went on to higher things, and both were very involved in the development of Concorde. And in my book, they were the top men in the country in the general aviation sense. You had specific designers, of course, whom we met frequently at Farnborough, brilliant men in this country too, like Sir Sidney Cam of Hawkers, and many of these people were so easy to talk to. They related well to test pilots, all of them. This was the thing I found quite fascinating. And interestingly enough, I found absolutely the same when I went to Germany after the war. I mean, once we'd captured a lot of these people like Kurt Tank of Focke Wulf, Willy Messerschmitt, Dr. Heinkel, I found them very easy to talk to because they could relate to pilots.
Did you gain any insight into the way in which CAM worked?
Oh, yes. So Sidney CAM was one of these people who had a wonderful eye for aesthetic form. He could sketch his idea on a piece of paper rapidly, and it always had these smooth flowing lines which made you realize that the aircraft looked so good you felt it must fly right. So Sidney didn't suffer fools gladly, but he was a man who has been working under pressure most of his life, pressure of war, etc., to produce the goods, and he always did. It was wonderful in that respect. The other great designer, of course, was Mitchell of Supermarines, who again, unfortunately, died at an early age, but a man much in the same stamp as Sir Sidney CAM, who produced the most magnificent Spitfire, of course. And I didn't ever meet Mitchell, but I knew his successor well, Joe Smith. But Joe's job was mainly developing the Spitfire so that it could achieve or keep up with the opposition throughout the war. As you know, many, many marks and models of Spitfire were built, each of them going faster or going higher or having more armament, etc. That was Joe Smith's task, and he did it brilliantly. So we had the right men in the right places, and wonderful airplanes were produced. I mean, like The ones that spring to my mind as the superb airplanes of World War II on the British side are, of course, inevitably the Spitfire and the Mosquito and the Lancaster. These are the three that stand out in my mind. I flew them all enormously amount of time, and I thought they were absolutely splendid airplanes. There is no doubt about it. Germans, of course, could match us. They had three brilliant airplanes on their side. They had the Focke-Wulf 190. They had the Ju-88. And, of course, the outstanding aircraft of World War II, the Messerschmitt 262. When I say outstanding, I mean the most formidable. But, of course, outstanding is probably not the right word, because it never was allowed to get to its full potential, because it wasn't built in big enough numbers. It was also wrongly used for the first year of its life, because Hitler dictated it should be used as a fighter bomber instead of a pure fighter. And then when it did come into its own as a fighter, Germany was out of experienced pilots that could handle this machine.
I'm a bit surprised that you say that the Messerschmitt jet was the outstanding plane of World War II. Do you mean just on the German side?
I mean most formidable. No, I mean most formidable aircraft that was ever produced in World War II. You have to realize it was like talking about football. You have the 1st Division, the 2nd Division and the 3rd Division. It's much the same in aircraft. Nowadays you have a Premier League, which is something extra right above. The only aircraft in that league was the ME-262. It was so fast that nothing could really get near it. The odd one was shot down, but when? On either takeoff or landing, when it was slowing down. It was really a formidable aeroplane. Very fast, heavily armed, and with the only weakness, of course, was the fact that its engines had a very short life, which, as I told you, 25-hour scrap life. So the engines were very temperamental.
I'm a bit surprised that in the three German aircraft you name as outstanding, you don't mention the 109.
No, I don't. I didn't think... I think the 109 succeeded because, in spite of itself, it... was not a nice airplane, particularly a nice airplane to fly. Many Germans will tell you it was, but of course, if you fly an airplane long enough, you begin to know its thing and you accept it. But you have to realize, as a test pilot, I was able to compare it with a vast range of aircraft, and I certainly did not ever think it was a great airplane. I think it was a wonderful workhorse in the war as a fighter aircraft. But its problems were it had some nasty handling characteristics, which were a disadvantage in combat. It was a very claustrophobic aeroplane to fly, tiny cockpit, and it was not an easy aeroplane to land in bad weather or anything like that, because the view was terrible. And altogether, it had, as I said, was not the same class as the Focke-Wulf 190.
What was so good about the 190?
Well, the 190 was a beautiful aircraft to handle, magnificent to fly and maneuver. It was very fast for a piston-engined aircraft, and it had nice characteristics even to fly in bad weather. One must realize that in Europe you have to take into account very closely what an aeroplane can do in bad weather, because the continent of Europe is not blessed with the weather, for example, that you find in the Gulf of Mexico, and this the Americans found much to their cost when they came to Europe first. So you have to assess an aeroplane in that respect. And that's why I say the Focke-Wulf was a much nicer airplane to handle in bad weather than the 109.
What can you say from your own personal experience about the comparison between the Spitfire and the Hurricane from flying them?
The Hurricane was the aircraft for the right season. It came at a time when it literally saved the country. It was there, it was needed, and it performed magnificently. It was a very good fighter in its day, but it was rapidly outstripped after the Battle of Britain by other aircraft the enemy had in the matter of performance. The Hurricane had reached the limit of its development, really, whereas the Spitfire was just beginning the start of its development. But of course, one must always, one must never forget that the Hurricane took two-thirds of the brunt of the Battle of Britain.
Why do you think the Spitfire was a failure as a fleet aeroplane?
Oh, for two fundamental reasons. It was too delicate an aeroplane for a very harsh environment. When you fly an aeroplane onto the deck of an aircraft carrier, you're plucked out of the sky when you're doing about 90 miles an hour and crashed onto a deck without much delicacy. The aircraft is subjected to huge strains in both retardation and in vertical velocity. And it has to be specifically designed to meet these very harsh requirements. The Seafire, that is the naval version of the Spitfire, was never designed for this sort of work. It was adapted to it. Second thing was, it had really quite appalling view when you were coming in to deck land, because you must realize you're approaching this small postage stamp floating on the sea at a speed that demands that the nose is cocked up well to slow the aircraft down. And your view with this very long engine in front of you was quite appalling. So these two facts, I think, made the Spitfire unsuitable fundamentally for naval work. Although one has to say, when you got it in the air, it was absolutely superb. But the operational losses were probably far higher than the losses that we inflicted on the combat, on the enemy in combat, the Seafire.
When did you first fly the Meteor?
When I was at Farnborough in the secret jet flight. That would be in 1944.
Can you remember the first time you flew it? What happened?
Very well. Yes, it was very impressive. It was not particularly heavily powered. The first engines that went into the Meteor, in fact, were considerably underpowered. So you didn't get the impression of charging down the runway at absolutely full acceleration, rather like a dragster car, which some of the later jets had, of course. It was rather a ponderous takeoff in the early one. But of course, the thing that impressed you about the first jets were when you'd been used to piston engine aircraft, you suddenly found yourself sitting in an aeroplane with the most wonderful view ahead of you, because there was no engine sitting there sticking out in front of you. There was this lack of vibration which you associate with piston engine aircraft, and also, strangely enough, a lack of noise. Although the jet may have been making quite a thunderous noise, it was all well behind the pilot, so you were flying in a comparatively quiet environment, and of course a very speedy environment too. Thing could really move through the air. It was really quite a revelation after piston engine aircraft.
So you really had the sense of a new age?
Sorry?
You really had the sense of a new age?
Oh, absolutely. You were in no doubt about that at all. Yep, no doubt about that at all. I think the two things that made me feel we were in a new age was first flying the jet engine and second flying the swept back wing. And of course, the first airplane to have this combination was the ME-262.
Which other aircraft of the war vintage of other countries did you get to know very well? Did you ever fly any of the Japanese planes?
Yes, but not many, but I flew the Japanese Zero. And that was an outstanding airplane as a fighter. It is probably one of the most maneuverable fighters I've ever flown in my life. But it had a dreadful Achilles heel. It was so light, the gauge of the metal that was used to construct this aircraft was so thin that it could not take much in the way of punishment. And although it could survive reasonably well against 303 bullets, once the .5 machine gun bullet and the 20mm cannon came into being, if you got a hit on the Zero, you did it a lot of damage. The pilot was very unprotected, really. He had no bulletproof windscreen. He had very little, if any, armor plating protect him. So it was a very, very exposed situation for the Japanese pilot.
I'd always thought of the Typhoon as an outstanding aircraft. You haven't mentioned that.
No. I certainly don't consider the Typhoon as an outstanding fighter. It was anything but an outstanding fighter. But where it did make its mark was that it was a very, very able ground attack airplane. It was very good in this respect, but it was not a great fighter because it had very poor high-level performance, had a lot of trouble with the engine. The Napier Sabre engine at that time was really not developed to a degree of reliability that the operational service deserved. Its successor, the Tempest, was a much better airplane. But as I say, the Typhoon still made a tremendous mark as a ground attack aircraft.
Which other test pilots were your particular friends in the 40s?
Well, I had some very good friends right across the board. Let's start with them. Geoffrey de Havilland Sr., Geoffrey de Havilland Jr., who was killed in the DH-108. But he and I worked closely on many things. In fact, I did the accident investigation work on DH-108 to find out what had caused his death. At Hawkers, I was very friendly with Philip Lucas, test pilot there, and with Bill Humble, and with Wimpy Wade. All of them flew for Hawkers. And Supermarines, there was, of course, the great Geoffrey Quill and Mike Lithgow. And for Hawkers, for a while, there was another very good test pilot called